Estoy muy emocionado por estar aquí en la Fundación Rafael del Pino, pero necesito hablar en inglés. Primero, entonces, el video, José.
By joining us here today, you are now part of the Singularity University global community. Singularity University is a B Corp, an impact organization, located at the NASA Research Park in the midst of Silicon Valley. Our mission is to educate, inspire, and empower leaders and their communities across the globe to address today's grandest challenges using exponentially advancing technologies. We at Singularity University understand that we cannot do this alone. And we understand that real impact is going to happen with you and your communities at a local level. While the ideas here today represent those of Singularity University, our faculty, our founders, this entire event is the work of your Singularity University local chapter. So thank you to all of them for making today happen. We hope that you'll be inspired by today's program. Now enjoy the show.
Gracias. So again, I'm very excited to be here tonight, and I'm very appreciative of the Fundación Rafael del Pino for hosting us and for hosting the GIC. It's really amazing to be here in Madrid and to see what a wonderful group of people that are here and the innovation that is happening coming out of Madrid. So I'm going to talk tonight about exponential technologies and how they are empowering change with groups. And you just saw the founders of Singularity University. We just heard from Peter, who many of you know, is founder of XPRIZE and is known very well for the commercialization of space. And on the other side of the slide is Ray Kurzweil. Ray is a futurist, a thinker, a scientist. And Ray was doing his research in the late 90s, early 2000s, and was seeing that there is a point in time when artificial intelligence will become so advanced that we, using our human intelligence, will not be able to stay on top of it. And he called that moment in time when these two meet the point of singularity. And he wrote a book about it called The Singularity is Near. Well, Peter went on a hiking trip in Chile, and Peter read this book and saw the kinds of change that was coming, and Peter wondered, why isn't there a university out there that is actually helping people to learn about this and to approach solutions for the world's biggest problems about this? So then Peter used the model that he used for the International Space University that was founded in France, not far away, that had a summer session where people would come for 10 weeks, and these people would spend 10 weeks in an intensive program to learn about space, and then they go off into the farthest part of the world to actually work at space organizations. And now I believe there are 3,700 people who have graduated from the International Space University. Well, Peter said, let's set up something that's like that, and that's Singularity University. So in 2008, they founded Singularity University with the mission that we need to educate, inspire, and empower leaders to apply exponential technologies to address humanity's global and grand challenges. And I'll talk about the various piece parts of this because it's really important that we have an understanding of just what we're trying to do at Singularity University. So in looking at the vision, what is the impact, or how are we going to inspire people? We are asking people to think in terms of how will you impact a billion people in the next 10 years? So a billion is a really large number, and a billion is meant to inspire people to think really, really big about these really strong problems, these really hard problems. And we want people to use exponential technologies. And what do we mean by exponential technologies? Exponential technologies are these things that have gotten faster and faster and more powerful and cheaper over the last several years, and it's only going to continue this way. So we're talking about artificial intelligence, biotechnology, networks, nanotechnology. These are the tools that we're going to be using to address the grand challenges. And what are these grand challenges? The grand challenges are each of these 11 areas that we see as being the problem areas that we can bring exponential technologies to bear and make the world a better place for a billion people. And so why are we using exponential technologies? Isn't what we had just a few years ago good enough? Well, it's really looking ahead to the fact that, as Einstein said, we cannot solve our problems with the same thinking that we used when we created them. So we know that we need to be anticipating what are the technologies that are coming out. We know that we need to be helping other people to learn about the technologies that are coming out in order for us to be able to solve these grand challenges. Now, when I speak of exponential, I talk about this doubling effect. And a doubling effect is the notion that if I take 30 steps from here, I can take 30 steps and probably make it to the exit over there. The human mind is really good at thinking about linear steps. When I talk about exponential steps, I'm talking about the fact that my first step covers 1 meter, my next step will cover 2 meters, and then 4, and then 8, and 16, etc. So each step gets more and more distance with a step that's covered. So that's what we think around exponential thinking. So if I take these steps, you saw me, I took 30 linear steps to get to the door, but if I take 30 exponential steps, I don't make it 100 feet, I don't make it 1,000 feet, I don't make it 1,000,000 feet, I actually go around the world 25 times in taking 30 exponential steps. It's hard for us to really comprehend that kind of scale, but we've seen this kind of scale just in the way that we've been developing technology over the last decades. So computing, the computers that everybody seems to be carrying around in their pockets, I know that I have one that I brought with me from California, you may recognize it, some of you have an iPhone as well. These computers have been getting faster and faster following what's called Moore's Law, where the price performance of computing has gotten doubly as fast and as cheap every 18 months for a very long time. So we've seen it go from the electromechanical, by way of punch cards that it's on the side, through relays and vacuum tubes and transistors into the integrated circuit. And things have gotten smaller and smaller and faster and cheaper, allowing us to do exponentially more difficult things. So an example with integrated circuits, these little teeny tiny, really powerful things. So we look in 1958, the first time that we had the first integrated circuit, there were a whopping 2 transistors on that circuit. When we flash forward to 1971, we brought out the Intel 40-04, which had 2,300 transistors. And just in 2012, which is at least 2 cycles old, we have over 7 billion transistors on the same chip. And you can see there at the bottom of the math, we've gotten a 100 billion-fold improvement in computing power since just 1958. If we look at something else that we're all familiar with, again, folks have, I see some of you taking pictures with your phone right now. We look back to the very first digital camera that was made, and it had what I would consider throwaway quality right now, of 0.01 megapixels. It weighed 4 pounds, and it cost $10,000. Now, looking at the iPhones that are around you and what people are able to use, we can have mobile digital cameras that have extremely high resolution, and they're extremely light. We can now put them on birds, we can put them on dogs, we can put them all over the place, and it's only $10. So again, we have seen a billionfold, if not more, improvement in just a short period of time. This kind of exponential technological development is really what leads to the vaporization of the desk as we know it. So when I started working, this is pretty much what my desk looked like. I think it was a little bit before the fax machine was available. But if you look around, many of you can recognize some of the things that are on here. We got fax machine, we got a globe, we have our Rolodex, we have a bulletin board, we have a filing cabinet down below. Well, what happens if we actually turn these in and we use exponential technology to shrink them down and put them on something different than what we see right here? So now we see that it begins to disappear. Things become an app, and that app goes onto your computer, and then the next step is going to be that we're going to see the computer disappear. But what are the 3 things that remain at the end of this? The 3 things that remain are the desktop, the phone, and the sunglasses. Now, I'm really waiting for somebody who can digitize sunglasses so that I don't have to break them every time I travel. But this is where we see all this innovation over just the last few years. This kind of thing has made all these things convenient, and it's made it so that we can all carry around our offices with us at any given time, and it makes it really interesting for us to actually start to work together, because it's no longer a matter of, do we go one place to meet and make sure we have the tools with us, and did you forget it? No, I need to go home and get it again. We have our entire office with us no matter where we are. So I'm going to let this play one more time so you can see it all disappear. And then I'm going to bring up a new slide, and poof, there it goes. So now I'm going to talk about how do these tools help us to engage community. And I want you to take a look at this desktop here. it's not as clean as the last one was at the end of the cycle. Why is this? Well, we see that the sunglasses are still there, because nobody's invented the digital sunglasses yet. But we also see that people have paper and pens. People have paper and pens because they have excellent battery life. We don't yet need to worry about paper or pen running out of battery life and not being able to access it. So we're still using the tools that have gotten us here, but by way of having the computer, calculator kind of, but the phone, we're moving into the future where people can engage communities using all kinds of new exponential tools. So at Singularity University, we have brought people through to start thinking exponentially, and we have so far educated over 10,000 people to think about exponential technologies, to think about how do we solve these global grand challenges. And these folks have gone out to the various parts of the world. They come from 95 different countries, and I'm looking forward, I hope by the end of this year, we'll be at the big fat 100 mark. But these 10,000 folks have gone out there and are now bringing to their small groups the way that they're thinking now, this transformation of how are we applying exponential technologies to solve problems. When I think of how groups are organized, I rely on what Clay Shirky of New York University had come up with back in the day. So he said, if any of you have read his book called Here Comes Everybody, Organizing Without Organizations, he puts forth this theory that groups come together based on three things. And those three things are the group has a promise, the group has a tool, and the group has a bargain. And this applies to several different things, and I'll share with you how this actually plays out. So the notion of a promise is, what is it that we can do as a group that I can't do by myself? What is it that I, working with other people, am able to achieve that I can't do on my own? It used to be, even just 10 years ago, the size of group that I needed to join to get something done actually needed to be pretty big. But thanks to technology and the social tools that we have now, that group is getting smaller and smaller, but the size of opportunity is staying the same. The size of potential is staying the same. The notion of a promise for a group is people understanding at an intrinsic level, what is it that we can do together? And the extrinsic level is our ability to show others to lure them in to join our group. At Singularity University, we like to think in terms of a 10x opportunity rather than a 10% improvement. And the promise of groups that use exponential tools is really to achieve that 10x impact on the world, and that's what we will need for our global grand challenges. Now, what about the tools that we use? So I love Archimedes' quote, that give me a place to stand and a lever long enough and I will move the world. What turns out that exponential tools are allowing us to have an exponentially long lever, which means that fewer people are needed in order to move the world. The notion of a tool is, what do we use as a group to communicate or to try and make something happen? And the notion of a promise and a tool with a group is different from a marketing problem. A marketing problem is basically saying, what do you as a group want to buy together? That's what marketers are starting to get really good at, is how do I get you to buy something? But what organizers are trying to do is, what can we do together? Not buy together, but do together. And the tools are the things that we use to do together. It was, for a while, it was moving away from a paper newsletter to email, and now to text and WhatsApp and things that disappear with Snapchat and others. These are communicating tools that bring us together. We had wikis that came on, and now we're having 3D printing, and we're having other tools that will allow us to actually participate in a group to achieve things that we otherwise couldn't. And then what is the promise? What are the rules of the road of the group? If I join this group, what can I expect the group to do, and what does the group expect of me? A really easy example that many of us probably have already graduated through was the first time we came online, and we typed in all capital letters. And people said, oh, you're yelling. We don't do that when we communicate online. We use regular typing, capital letters, small letters. It's just like writing a letter. My parents were really big problems in this, of typing in all caps, but they learned. Another example of what is the bargain that a group has is that we agree that we treat each other civilly. If we're in a mailing list, the mailing list allows us to be able to communicate with everybody at once. And we behave when we communicate with everybody at once. We don't start yelling at each other. We don't start talking off topic. But that is a bargain that we have as a group, is that we are acting civilly to each other. So we have the promise, we have the tool, and we have the bargain. And what this brings up is a really interesting notion around how do we engage problems based on what is the duration of the problem? Is it a short-term problem? Is it a long-term problem? And what's the size of the group that we have? So again, rewinding about a decade or so ago, as mobile communication got faster and faster and more people had cell phones and the ability to text, well, then we were able to occupy this square down here. People were just like, we have the ability to organize at a moment's notice. And how do we do this? We did it in flash mobs. It was fun first, because we would say, hey, everybody, we're going to go here. We're going to do this thing. The promise was that we were going to entertain. The tool was we're going to use our phones to coordinate when and where. And the bargain was you show up and you do it no matter how silly you look. Oh, and somebody needs to video it. And that was the idea of the flash mob. It came and it went. And it was really easy to do because it was a small group of people dealing with something in a short period of time. Entertainment was first, but then people started to use it to organize for advocacy reasons, to organize protests, to organize things that were of the moment. And we realized that, okay, this is something that occupies that small group of people in the short term. Can we do something that's more of a long-term problem? So what came about then was Wikipedia. Wikipedia occupies that other side of this four square, because you have a large group of people dealing with a long-term problem. And what enabled this, so the promise was, how can we, all working together, bring all the world's knowledge in a way that anybody can get to it? The tool was the wiki. The tool was everybody has a chance to be able to add something, everybody has a chance to edit something, and the bargain was, we do it in a neutral point of view. So that was one of the important things about Wikipedia, is that the people who participated in it and made revisions and made edits and added new content, what is that they were able to talk about really sticky problems because they adopted a neutral point of view. So the bargain was, we're not going to say pro this or anti this, we're going to present it in a neutral way. So these were actually the easiest things to deal with. And now we have to go to the harder parts. And the harder parts are the empty squares right now. The harder parts is, how do you get a really large group of people to work on a short duration problem? And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we have to atomize some problems in order to get a large group of people to participate. The notion that we can get a lot of sophistication out of people to operate on a problem-solving level, that requires years of investment to be able to get people to that point where they can actually deal with things in a sophisticated way. What if we can make the problem really, really small and make it easy for people to do so that it doesn't require a whole lot of effort, but it requires a whole lot of people to get it done? So this is where we started to see things like Amazon's Mechanical Turk come in. And Amazon's Mechanical Turk basically allowed somebody who had a problem, like, let's say I have a whole collection of 1 million photographs that need to be recognized. And I need somebody just to go through and tag each photo so that then I can go and sell it to someone else to say, I have 1 million photos in this collection and 1,500 of them are trees. Well, at the time that this came out, we didn't yet have the optical recognition or the processing available for us to have computers do this for us. So Mechanical Turk basically allowed me, as the one who has the problem, to engage a large group of people. And the promise was that all of us doing just a couple pictures could get through 1 million pictures very quickly. And all of us just paying attention to a couple pictures meant that I could quickly add 3 or 4 tags to it and move on to the next one. I could do it in the morning, I could do it at night, I could do it when I couldn't sleep because I'd flown across the ocean. It was at my convenience. The tool that we used was this tool that Amazon built, which basically atomized this big problem into small little pieces. And then the bargain was, it was actually a payment mechanism. I could pay people $1 per photo. So it was up to the person to decide if they wanted to participate in this project with me. And if they did, they could do one picture, they could do 10 pictures, they could do 100 pictures. But Amazon Turk was able to disassemble it into the atomized parts and then reassemble it for me to have my million pictures done. We'll flash forward to where we are today. And if you go to captionphoto.io, then you can see that you add all the pictures in and an AI robot or an AI program will actually do all that for you in a fraction of the time, and it'll do it for free. So now what we've seen is that when we get large groups of people attacking a short-term problem, that is ripe for artificial intelligence, or even robots, to be able to tackle what's in that part of the square. And the more that they deal with that, then that leaves us to be able to find what is the next challenge, what is the next thing that we can atomize, bring it down to its component parts and solve, because we're really good at that as humans still. Pre-singularity, we're really good at that. So now let's look at what is the long term with a small group of people. And where this actually shows up the most at Singularity University is that this is where we have our global grand challenges. Those 11 challenges that I talked about earlier. The fact that now we have exponential technology that can let small groups make big changes, we now see the global grand challenges is an example of this long-term challenge that can be handled by lots of small groups of people. That same thing that allows us to be able to automate the atomization and the assembly of things that Amazon Turk did and now PhotoCaption.io does is the same thing that we can do around all of the efforts that are being done by small groups of people to solve our grand challenges. So the global grand challenges are what the Global Solutions Program here at Singularity University immerses the people who have a chance to go through it in. The way that our Global Solutions Program works is that we educate and empower people in teams to create and develop innovative solutions that can transition into viable startups using exponential technology. This is our 10-week program that happens during the summer, and here we have a rough layout of what those 10 weeks encompass. And what's really important to note about the Global Solutions Program is that up front, we get people to understand the key ideas, exponential technology, to think about the global grand challenges, to think about linear thinking, to think about, okay, what's the idea that brought you here? And now let's tuck that away so we can introduce you to all kinds of things that are around the Silicon Valley. And then we break into core curriculum. People actually dive deep with experts. They go on site visits to other parts of Silicon Valley to see things in action, whether it's robots, AI. They get a chance, I think, to go to Google and see the Google car and all that great stuff. And then they have workshops that allow them to synthesize and allow them to converge their thinking around what is a solution going to look like. They can prototype things. They can build things with 3D printers. They can use robots. They can actually start using these tools of the future to start thinking about what are these projects going to be. And then they break into teams, and these teams create projects. And what's really important about the Global Solutions Program is that they then launch the projects. And what we want them to do is to go off and make viable companies with this. So it's not just enough to have an idea. It's not just enough to have a group. But the promise of this group coming together using these tools is that they'll create a viable organization, for-profit or non-profit, but that viable organization will now be able to continue the work going forward. So this 10 weeks is not just about educating, this 10 weeks is about activating and getting people into the mode of creating something that can last. So who attends the GSP? We have two ways for people to get into the GSP. One is to do a direct application to us at Singularity University, and the other, which is my favorite, is why we're here, the Global Impact Competitions, especially the Global Impact Competitions. Because what we see in the GICs is these kinds of ideal candidates surface, and they surface in interesting parts of the world that we otherwise would not be able to find. I was really thrilled to hear that we have 500 applications in this year's GIC, which means an extremely competitive field to get a seat at one of our Global Solutions Programs. Our breakout of our ideal cohorts, because we take all of the winners of the GICs and then all the applications that come in otherwise, we actually are looking for people who are global, meaning that they don't have a Silicon Valley lens on them. It's gender balanced, meaning that it doesn't have the makeup of Silicon Valley, which tends to be a lot more men than women. that they have a diversity of thought and expertise. And this is going back to the way that groups work. We celebrate the difference. And the difference is that we want to have as many different backgrounds coming to look at a problem as possible. Because the kinds of solutions that people who come from different backgrounds come up with are a lot less brittle than people who come around who have the same background. It allows people to be able to think through solutions, if you're coming from different backgrounds, think them through before they get out into the world and break of something that you could have caught earlier on. And then finally, believe it or not, we're looking for technical and non-technical people. So sure, we want the people who can code. Yes, we want the people who are familiar with technology. But again, celebrating the difference, we need people who are not just that way, but can tell stories, can help to synthesize, can help to bring teams together so that it becomes a viable thing. So in 2015, our cohort actually had over half of them were women, and there were 45 different countries that were represented in there. So we're really trying to bring as many people from the corners of the world to Silicon Valley so that they can come back out and innovate in their home countries. So now it's about the global impact competitions, why we're here tonight. The global impact competitions are a way for us to be able to build community out in various parts of the world. The global impact competitions allow us to be able to inspire people and share the message of Singularity University and share this notion of how would you, given a really big vision, how would you solve something that's close to home? How would you solve the problem that affects a million people around you? Not a billion people, but a million people. That tends to be a step higher thinking than people otherwise have when they enter into these competitions. And what I've discovered, or what we've discovered, and confirmed with our director of the Global Solutions Program, is that the candidates that come through these global impact competitions are actually the best candidates we have at the Global Solutions Program. And that confirms to me this notion of distributed leadership and decentralization of Singularity University. How do we not just have everything have to come to Moffett Field in order to be successful? How can we actually tap into what are the various parts of the world where things are already happening, and we can provide a little bit of that turbo juice to make it even more impactful? So you see that some of the GICs that are being hosted here and elsewhere in the world, but the one thing that is missing is what's happened here. I'm so absolutely thrilled to see the support of the Fundación, Rafael Del Pino. You've been absolutely amazing in being able to provide the sustenance that we need and the scholarships to be able to send people to Singularity University. And looking back at this distinguished list of winners, to me, it's amazing to see what they have done in just the few short years since they won the GIC and came to the GSP. And what I'm even more excited about tonight is to understand who's going to win. Who are going to be the next two people that come to Singularity University and go through the Global Solutions Program? I actually don't know who those two people are, but I know that there are people among us who actually do. And so with that, I'll bring my talk to an end and open for some questions and answers before we get to what we're all here for, which is finding out who goes. Thank you.
Pues, ¿preguntas para Tomás?
No.
Ah. Mira, una por aquí.
Good afternoon, Tomás. Thank you very much for your talk. I'm Ana María Llopis. I'm chairman of a listed company in Spain and also have Ideas for All, which is a startup on sharing ideas and crowdsourcing and so forth. My question is, what happens after this young people or group of people go to Singularity University, establish the 10 weeks, activate a company, activate a project? Mm-hmm. What happens afterwards when they go back to their homes, their companies? Do you see any changes after that? What's the aftermath?
So changes that we Singularity University...
Yeah, I mean, how Singularity University impacts on them, mm-hmm. and when they go back to their projects, their homes, their countries, what do they do? Do you see a change? Do you see an exponential organization moving from their own projects, or what do you see after that? Do you follow that?
Yes. So that's an easy thing for me to answer, is to say that yes, we do follow them, sometimes better than others. And the way that we're really interested in how do we actually quantify this notion of 1 billion people being impacted by the work of Singularity University. And that comes in two different ways. One is the actual quantified impact. So how many people were helped? What were they helped doing? If it is in, let's say, clean water, how many gallons of water were cleaned? How many gallons of wastewater were saved from going out into the environment? So those are the quantified metrics that we can actually come up with great dashboards and measure, and that's the easy part. The harder part is the qualitative. It's the stories that we tell. And I know that we are getting better at Singularity University of telling those stories, but I think that I, again, point out to the decentralization. The folks who are here in the local chapters know exactly what has happened since people went off and came back. You have some really amazing GSP graduates, Singularity University alumni who are here, and I see you throughout the audience, who have had a fantastic effect. And just as with any entrepreneurial endeavor, sometimes it's really a great impact, and sometimes maybe you need to try again. But it's not so much what is the direct impact and can we trace that line? It's the transformational thinking. People, when they go through Singularity University and they think about exponential technologies and they think about how do we approach the world's problems, I find that we're inherently optimistic because we believe that technology can help us. We don't have this dystopian future where the robots are going to come and rule us over. We think about how can technology actually make the world a better place. And as we get more and more people who are operating this way and coming back to the various parts of the world to have that positive impact, I think that we'll see more and more of it, to then have the stories we can tell over and over again and help people through this change management of, there's changes happening so fast, it's kind of scary, to this change is happening really fast, but I think I know how we can harness it.
¿Otra pregunta por aquí?
Hi, congratulations, Thomas, for your presentation. My name is José Luis Arco. I'm coming from University of Granada. I am an educator. I was really impressed when I just arrived and wrote the Rafael Del Pino legacy, and it's amazing. Could you please mention, no, maybe one example, but one of the key areas in which Singularity University is experiencing more progress after applying your model, which is, by the way, very amazing. But which one of those table of about 12-9 problems, global problems, are you experiencing, observing more progress, and why?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
That's really good. So the 11 grand challenges, you're right between 9 and 12. Right there. So the 11 grand challenges, if I think about where we have seen some, I think that we're still at the beginning of seeing the impacts in the 11 grand challenges, because the ideas that are coming to mind aren't, and we have solved this, the idea is, and we're seeing traction in this. And so the notion of, let's look at food. So food is one of our grand challenges. How can we make sure that we have enough food, nutritious food, that people can eat, so there is no hunger. When we think about the application of exponential technologies, we're able to look at how robots are actually beginning to help us to farm. So when I grew up in the U.S., my idea of a farm was these really big machines that would drive through the fields, and they would plant, they would harvest, they would till the ground, but it was on a really large scale. And because the cost of these machines is going down and down and down, because the intelligence of these machines is going up and up and up, we now actually have much smaller robots that can do the work in a much more focused way than their larger counterparts of decades ago. Why is this important? Because if you think of any tract of land, we used to throw, if something happened to one plant, farmers are risk averse. If they see that something is dry, they water it. And they don't water just that one plant, they water the whole field, because that's what our systems are affected to be able to do. If they see that there is a bug on one plant, then typically they put pesticide over the entire field, whether it needs it or not. They see that one is undernourished, they put fertilizer over the entire field or not. Well, now we have the ability to be able to monitor down to the square foot in a field, and we can deploy robots to water or fertilize or to get rid of pests in a non-chemical way at the plant level instead of having to do it at the field level. So think of the savings that we have in terms of we don't need to use as much water, we don't need to buy as much fertilizer, we don't need to put as much pesticides into our foods in order to be able to cultivate these fields. And that's just the AI and robotics part of how the food challenge is being handled. So that's where there are these across all 11, and I encourage people to go to singularityu.org to be able to read about the other global grand challenges and the progress that we're making. So thank you.
Y una última pregunta.
Gracias, Gerardo Seliger. How do you, with exponential technology, will be able to reduce, hopefully exponentially, unemployment? One of the Spain's biggest problems is youth unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a danger that with exponential technology, maybe jobs will be lost.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way you can build the bridge?
So I think I can conceptually build a bridge, but I don't know if I can practically build a bridge here for Spain. So conceptually, if you, everybody imagine with me, we have those four squares of short and long duration and small group and large group. So conceptually, we can think about how exponential technology can actually start to make jobs because we can atomize the things that need to be done in ways that we couldn't before. We used to need one person who was highly trained to be able to do a particular job. And that one person who was highly trained needed to be scheduled for a certain amount of time, whether they were actually needed to do it or not. And now we have things like Uber. We have things that we call the gig economy, which is the part-time. We call it the gig economy. I don't know how that translates. Okay, sharing economy is another way. Thank you very much. The sharing economy that allows people to opt in and opt out as it's available. So again, going back to what we were talking about with farming, where things happened at a big scale because that's how we manage things, now we're able to manage it down to the task level. And people don't have to dedicate 40 hours of their week on a job that may or may not be busy, but they can actually decide how they're going to participate in the economy. It's not in the traditional way that we've done it, but because we can atomize the things that need to get done, people can pick off what they can actually do. And as employers, we don't have to think about, am I going to hire somebody into this full-time job that may only be seasonal? And how do I deal with if I don't need them anymore? The sharing economy is allowing us to be able to deploy our resources and employ our resources in different ways. Some may say better ways. But again, wait 18 months and it'll probably look a lot different.
Pues nada, muchísimas gracias. Un aplauso a Tomás. Thank you.